This is episode 41 of the Fifth Estate podcast. Scott Linsicum, trade protectionism, and are you down with TPP?
Folks, Neil Doing here to tell you about our friends at Casper. Casper is a sleep brand that created one perfect mattress sold directly to consumers, eliminating commission-driven inflated prices. Its award-winning sleep surface was developed in-house, has a sleek design, and is delivered in a small how-did-they-do-that-size box. In addition to the mattress, Casper also offers an adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. The mattress industry has forced consumers into paying notoriously high markups. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to the consumer. The Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. An in-house team of engineers spent thousands of hours developing the Casper. Its supportive memory foam offers a sleep surface that's got just the right sink and just the right bounce. Plus, its breathable design sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature throughout the night. With over 20,000 reviews and over 4.8 out of 5 stars, it is quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. Buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free. Casper offers free delivery and free returns to the US and Canada with a 100-night home trial. That's 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. Now, a special offer for our listeners. Get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/fifth and using fifth as your promo code. That's www.casper.com/fifth, promo code fifth.
And it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I am here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Doing. How are you?
Little under the weather, Jay. I think the pollen is out for some reason. It's out to get me.
Everybody's got allergies now. Is going to start sneezing and coughing and all that good stuff. It's always fun.
Wheezing, hacking. But you know what might make me feel a little bit better?
What's
is
that?
If our listeners who haven't already done so would venture on over to iTunes and give us a review. Rate us and review. That helps us to increase awareness of the show, keep us out there.
Yes.
It's a functional antihistamine for me. So I
and it helps Neil's self-esteem. He likes that. When he sees those new reviews come in, it's music to his ears.
It is, especially the negative ones. Always the negative ones.
All right, so obviously with Donald Trump in office, trade has become a big issue. Obamacare and everything else is kind of dominate, but trade is going to be there. Trade's going to be big.
Trump made trade one of the centerpieces of his campaign.
Right.
Trade imbalances with China and Mexico and that sort of thing. So he put these issues front and center, and it remains to be seen exactly what's going to come about in the era of Trump. But we thought that we might get somebody who actually knows what he's talking about when it comes to this international trade stuff. So our guest for this episode is Scott Linsicum.
Returning guest.
He was, I think, guest number two for the show. It's been a year. A lot has happened.
Yeah.
But he's an international trade attorney and wears many hats. So, Scott, welcome back.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. I always enjoy being referred to as guest number two. that really that actually happens quite often. So
does it really?
Technically, I think you were guest number three.
Okay, that's
better. At least you're not referred to as number two.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah, well, and three's a trend, so yeah. That means that we had staying power, right?
Yeah, we did. We figured at that point, if we had three episodes, this thing was some people were listening. But now a lot more people are listening, Scott. So you've got to be on your A game.
Well, I'm really nervous now, as you can tell.
Yeah. I can tell. Yeah,
You can hear it in your voice.
Well, for those who haven't listened to the previous episode, Scott is you know he knows this subject backwards and forwards. He really is quite an expert on international trade, and so we're very pleased to have him with us to discuss this. So Scott, maybe we could start just by sort of getting a snapshot of the state of international trade.
Yep.
Right now, like globally, you know, is trade picking up? Is it slowing down? Maintaining current levels? What's the story?
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of treading water right now globally. You know, there was a pretty significant slowdown during the Great Recession. Then things picked up a good bit, kind of trying to get us back to normal. But we never really did get back to normal. And we've kind of just been kind of petering along, again, treading water, not accelerating where we used to be kind of this consistent acceleration. Instead, it's just kind of this very mediocre growth in global trade for reasons that people don't quite understand. I mean, part of it obviously is just that economic growth globally is still pretty slow, including in the United States. But there are also some other structural things that people really haven't quite figured out yet. Now, that is certainly not helped by what's going on here at home, which can only be described as massive uncertainty about the future of American trade policy. You know, Donald Trump made all these promises about what he was going to do, whether it be renegotiating NAFTA or slapping tariffs on Chinese imports or the rest. None of that, other than the withdrawal from the TPP, has actually occurred. China has not been declared a currency manipulator. We haven't withdrawn from any of our trade agreements that are currently in force. You know, and not only that, we have almost no senior staff in place in the Trump administration to even effectuate that policy. You know, Wilbur Ross over at the Commerce Secretary just got confirmed. Bob Lighthizer at USTR still hasn't been confirmed. And beyond that, a lot of the deputies in our agencies, be it Treasury, Commerce, or USTR, haven't even been nominated yet. So, you know, the formulation and implementation of U.S. trade policy, which in past administrations has really been kicking into high gear by March, here is still in flux. And then you add to that House Republicans have proposed a really radical overhaul of our tax code to impose a border adjustable corporate tax, which is basically a new consumption style tax that would tax import consumption and exempt export sales. Really, you have a lot of uncertainty about the future of American trade. And
so it's not as if the world community even has anything to react to quite yet. Well, just sort of what Trump has pronounced, and there's really just nothing happening.
Right. So, and the problem, however, is that business doesn't stand still. So they are reacting in the sense that they're simply not pursuing investment projects or going ahead with kind of their ordinary course of business. So there's a lot of stuff that I could, you know, you can say going on that we don't see with respect to everybody just basically sitting on his hands waiting for things to get done. Now, I have no idea if that's enough to show up in our economic data, but it certainly is occurring. I mean, you read reports all the time of CEOs, you know, on shareholder calls and stuff talking about how, look, there was just too much uncertainty in the U.S. market for us to push forward on X, Y, and Z. And then, you know, all the other stuff. You know, we don't know about Obamacare replacement. We don't know about tax reform. I mean, we are in a really crazy state of uncertainty.
We don't know what he's going to tweet next. So
exactly. So I'll tell you though, it has been a boom for lawyers and accountants and PR officials who have to advise nervous clients on all this type of stuff. You know, there's a lot of on the one hand, a lot of on the other hand, a lot of emergency tweet response teams being put together. So as usual, the winners are the lawyers.
Which is perhaps the most lamentable aspect of the entire affair.
Hey now, man. Lawyers got to eat. We have families too.
I suppose that's true.
Yeah.
I suppose that's true.
I guess. So, Scott, let me ask you a question. It's kind of a little bit off topic in terms of trade, but what effect is like commodity prices having on trade? So like oil just kind of, you know, plunged a little bit. And so has, you know, no matter what happens, I mean, OPEC is just saying they're going to cut production. Oil shoots up a little bit and then starts its decline again. I mean, you know, I'm loving it. I'm sure anybody who's driving is loving it, paying $2 for a gallon of gas when, you know, I still remember paying close to $4. What kind of effect is that having on you know, trade issues?
Yeah, I mean, so certainly commodity prices have a couple effects. First, and I think it's an important thing to note, is that, you know, we've had some pretty wild fluctuations in commodity prices over the last couple of years. And that actually has a pretty substantial effect on things like the trade deficit. And it's a good reason why we shouldn't obsess about the trade deficit. Because, you know, if oil prices shoot up and we import a lot of oil, it makes the trade deficit look a lot bigger because, of course, it's in dollars. And even though what we're actually importing is the same stuff. You know, and the same goes for our exports. And so it can really do a lot of kind of crazy things with those numbers. Beyond that, of course, you know, there are effects in kind of, you know, petro states, oil dependent economies, and so forth. So, you know, commodity prices can certainly cause a lot, wreak a lot of havoc with how you look at trade. And of course, certain economies that are dependent on those things.
It does. It has a ripple effect, these commodities, and you see it in, you know, it reaches all the way across, you know, the maritime industry. So moving on kind of to sort of a specific policy, I wanted to ask about TPP.
Sure.
Is it dead?
It certainly, if it's not truly dead, it's almost dead in the kind of the classic Princess Bride sense. That you know, it Donald Trump definitely drove a stake through its heart. The question now is what happens to the agreement that's lying there. So there are a few options. One is that the other 11 TPP parties do what Australia has been begging to do, and that is simply to cut the United States out of the deal, to copy and paste it in a new deal, renegotiate a couple of revisions on market access, and sign it without the United States. So they'd call it the TPP 11. Another option out there, which is being pushed by Japan, is to have everybody just negotiate separate bilateral deals. The United States Trump administration has also been pushing this idea that they're just going to go out and negotiate bilateral deals with everybody. A third option that people hold out hope for, I think it's pretty unlikely, is to just let the whole thing sit around for a couple years. And then bring it back up, rename it something else, and sign it in almost the current form. So, you know, it'd become the Trump Pacific Partnership or whatever the heck you'd call it. And then, you know, finally is just it dies. It dies. There's nothing replaces it. And, you know, you see a pretty significant opportunity for regional trade liberalization kind of just go down the tubes.
So that leads me to my next question. You know, so what are the foreign policy implications? What are, you know, of giving up this trade role in the region? Are we just like ceding the field to China?
Yeah. In a lot of senses, yes. So, you know, for those of us who are what we call true free traders, who actually think the best policy for the United States is just to lower our trade barriers, regardless of what any other country does. The TPP was kind of a mixed bag. Mixed bag in terms of, yes, we got into new markets like Japan and Malaysia and Vietnam, and yes, we were lowering most of our trade barriers, But you know, overall, there were other things in there, some labor and environmental rules that we didn't really like, some IPR stuff we didn't really like. And overall, it was kind of, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being horrible, 10 being amazing, you know, the thing got like a 7. But it's pretty much undeniable from the foreign policy context that TPP was a 10. That is a really big deal for the American foreign policy community to solidify the United States' influence in the region with a lot of important Asian economies. Certainly Japan, but I just mentioned Malaysia, Vietnam, obviously Australia, New Zealand, who are close allies anyway. And at the same time, to counterbalance a growing Chinese influence in the region, China is negotiating its own free trade agreement called the RCEP, Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, with almost all of the same TPP countries, plus India and a few others. And so
that's huge.
RCEP is still ongoing. It's not as comprehensive as TPP. It still is. Hasn't been completed, but you combine RCEP with the fact that China is already the biggest trading partner from almost all Asian nations. And what you see is, with the United States ditching TPP, really a retreat for our kind of economic influence in the region. And then you combine that with a lot of the hostile statements coming out of the White House with respect to reciprocal trade and currency manipulation and so forth. And again, targeting some of our allies in the Asia Pacific, it's not a good place to be right now, in terms of kind of the foreign policy aspects and kind of soft power aspects that we were going to get through TPP.
Well, on soft power, go ahead, Jay.
Go ahead. That's fine.
Well, I was just going to say, and soft power is you know, the app term to use, because, you know, one of the ways that we keep conflicts from arising is by establishing trade ties, you know, and that blunts and the sort of aggressive, you know.
The classic term is McDonald's diplomacy, right? That nations that have McDonald's don't actually go to war with each other. And there's a lot of truth to that. And, you know, this is another thing that really is confusing right now coming out of the Trump administration is, you know, Peter Navarro, who's in the National Trade Council and is a really kind of trade warrior type in the Trump White House, was just yesterday or 2 days ago, excuse me, talking about, you know, the need to reduce foreign investment in the United States. And at the same time, the Trump administration has, of course, been trying to discourage U.S. multinationals from investing abroad. And so what we're seeing is a coherent, or I mean, it's kind of incoherent, but in a sense, coherent policy of isolationism in the United States with respect to investment. That type of behavior, you know, not having our investments there, not having their investments here, you know, it provides more fertile ground for hot war type stuff. You know, it certainly doesn't mean it's going to happen, but, you know, economic isolationism makes that kind of stuff more likely.
Well, okay. So Scott, let me ask you some of the stuff that we're hearing coming out of the White House and even from some Republican circles are talking about, you know, with Mexico and everything, a quote unquote border adjustment tax, because they're saying, you know, our products are taxed when they go to these other countries, but we're not doing that when the products are coming in. What does that do for the American consumer in that respect? What about their proposals and what kind of effect will it have?
Right. So just for everybody who's listening, who isn't a complete nerd and following this stuff as religiously as I do and you guys do, the border adjustable tax, or what's also called the destination-based cash flow tax, or the romantically named DBCFT, basically what this does is it converts our corporate income tax into a corporate sales tax of sorts, where a corporation's sales revenue is taxed at a flat rate, and only for their U.S.-based sales. So their export sales are not taxed. But if they import goods and then resell them, those import sales are taxed and be the first time those types of import sales are taxed. So the Gap, for the first time, would have to pay tax on the full amount of a pair of blue jeans it sold instead of being able to deduct the import cost of those blue jeans. So it's a pretty radical change, and it really turns the corporate tax into kind of a VAT, value-added tax, with some additional wrinkles to it. The impact on consumers is pretty unclear in the United States. And the lack of clarity stems from the fact that traditional economic theory would say that the United States dollar is going to appreciate. So if you have a 20% DBCFT, you're going to see a 25% appreciation in the U.S. dollar. And that's going to essentially mute any sort of price or consumer effects in the United States. Basically, your dollar is going to be able to buy more. So the fact that you're paying 20% more is just no big deal, because you're able to buy more with your dollar. Of imports. The other side says there's no chance the dollar is going to appreciate by that much, at least not smoothly. And so if it doesn't appreciate by the full 25%, then the people left holding the bag are going to be American consumers. So you are going to see a pretty significant tax hike on consumers. You know, it's impossible to know who's right here, but what we do know is that the dollar is going to would appreciate pretty significantly, and that could have pretty serious implications in emerging markets for dollar-denominated debt and so forth. So there are a lot of potential pitfalls to this. Now, there are also a lot of benefits. You know, I'm not a huge opponent of the DBCFT. I'm kind of agnostic about it. But the fact is that it would raise a lot of revenue, about $1 trillion over 10 years, and that would permit the significant lowering of our corporate tax from 35% to, like I said, 20%. It would also permit other reductions and consolidations in the tax code, a lot of pro-growth changes there. The other important thing to note is, again, it's not inherently protectionist. You know, it's an internal tax. It's kind of like a sales tax in the sense that it's just anything that's sold here. If an import sold here, it gets taxed. If a domestic product sold here, it gets taxed. There are some problems with additional deductions there, but I won't get into that. But I will say, so there are some benefits. Now, there's also one thing that totally doesn't matter, and yet you hear it a lot. In fact, you guys just mentioned it. And that is the idea that we should care about what, say, Mexican exports face in our market versus what our exports face in the Mexican market. And the fact is that that's a ridiculous and pointless comparison. What you, from the trade context, you need to examine directly competitive products. So the comparison is the Mexican product sold in the United States and the American product sold in the United States. Or American product sold in Mexico versus the Mexican product sold in Mexico. That's where you have direct competition. And in both of those contexts, right now, you're seeing identical tax treatment. There's no benefit. A American export is taxed according to the Mexican VAT, and the American export has the American corporate tax. The Mexican product also faces the Mexican VAT and the Mexican corporate tax. So those two products are treated equally. And in the U.S. market, they're treated equally as well. You just have the American product gets the U.S. corporate income tax. The Mexican product faces the Mexican corporate income tax. And that's the end of it. So in that sense, this whole idea of it's not fair right now and it's the made in America tax, that's all nonsense. But, you know, it's a selling point. You know, right now, as you guys know, we're in a very kind of populist economic nationalist moment. And the pro-border adjustment tax folks have decided that this is a really great talking point, maybe to convince voters or maybe to convince the president that that tax is a good idea. But in reality, that is a pointless comparison they're making.
Interesting. Well, so Scott, based on all that and the other issues that we've touched on, what is your forecast for the next few years as when it comes to trade? Do you think there will actually be any changes? Are we going to see these border adjustment taxes implemented? Are we going to see anything like that happen? Or is it just a lot of hot air? Is the status quo going to reign supreme?
Well, I mean, so the answer I think is yes and no. Right now it looks like the border adjustable tax is, I'd say, maybe a 25% chance of getting passed. Uh-huh. Now, that's actually pretty high. I mean, it used to be about a 5% chance, but it's still less than 50% chance. There's a lot of opposition in the Senate. There's a ton of opposition from conservative and libertarian groups. And so, you know, the chances that the House GOP can find the votes and then get it passed in the Senate seems pretty small at this point.
So you'd say that would be a natural obstacle, is just lack of support in right. Congress. And
right. And there's even a conflict in the White House, you know, not a lot of there's a split in the White House in support. So beyond that, I do think, however, that the status quo will be more likely out in kind of the general trade policy. You know, so I don't think we're going to see the dissolution of NAFTA. I don't think we're going to see the United States exit from the World Trade Organization. I don't think we're going to see really major trade war type things, massive new unilateral tariffs, any of that. That said, we're certainly destined to have a far more aggressive and unilateralist U.S. trade policy when it comes to certain types of measures that are somewhat, I mean, I guess they're routine, but they haven't been used in a little while, and will cause some heartburn. Anti-dumping and countervailing duties, I think we're going to see an increase in the use of those, particularly for things like currency manipulation and the unilateral initiation of these cases by the administration, which hasn't happened really
ever. And Scott, just for our listeners who aren't familiar, could you just briefly define anti-dumping and countervailing duties?
Yeah, oh gosh. So dumping is the idea.
Yeah,
it's basically when a private foreign company sells in their market at a price lower than what they charge in the U.S. They sell in their market at a price higher than what they sell in the U.S. market. Uh-huh. That little price discrepancy is called dumping. Countervailing duties are for subsidies, government subsidies, and it's selling subsidized imports in the U.S. market. The United States can lawfully impose remedial duties on those products. And it's lawful. It's not. We have a lot of AD/CVD measures already in place right now, a lot of them in the steel industry and elsewhere. It's not very controversial, although some of the things that we might start doing would be a little more controversial. Certainly would get litigated at the WTO. We might see new, what we call safeguards cases, which are kind of global import surge escape clause cases against imports. And we might even see things under what's called Section 301 of the U.S. trade law, which allows for kind of unilateral reciprocal market opening measures. I won't get into the weeds, but those haven't been used in a couple decades because of the WTO coming on the scene, but we might see some of that come back. But the fact is that none of those things is going to collapse the global trading system. They're going to, you know, again, you'd see some heartburn, you'll see some crazy headlines, you'll certainly hear trading partners bitch and moan about it. But what you won't see is the type of crazy economic reactions and so forth that that were predicted based on some of Trump's more radical proposals. It doesn't look like we're going to see that.
So, Scott, will there be a party in the United States with a pro-trade agenda in 2020? Do you think an unambiguously pro-trade agenda? Or just no. Even a moderately pro-trade agenda?
No, I don't even think a moderately pro-trade agenda. Yeah. I mean, assuming that, well, I guess I'll put it this way. Assuming Donald Trump is still the president in 2020, I don't think you'll see a pro-trade party. You know, the Democratic Party does appear to be shifting on trade, but they still have far too much of a union and environmentalist constituency that is just adamantly anti-trade, and of course kind of far-left Bernie Sanders types that are adamantly anti-trade. So you're not going to see the Democratic Party agenda all of a sudden go back to kind of Clintonian free trade, and I mean Bill Clinton, because Hillary, right, of course, she all of a sudden became a pretty big protectionist. And then, you know, Trump is Trump. And as Trump goes, so goes the Republican Party. And you're also seeing, I think, the Republican Party has been kind of seduced by the snake oil of protectionism and the political benefits of going after places like, you know, Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio with promises of a return to manufacturing glory, however ridiculous and wrongheaded that is, and however failed our past protectionist policies have been, they see political success or political gold there. And so, I see very little chance that they're going to kind of recapture their past principles on trade when they see the political benefits of abandoning them.
And on that pleasant note, I think we're going to take a short break and be right back.
Hi, I'm Megan McCain. You're listening to The Fifth Estate with Neil and Jay.
Okay, and we are back. Our guest is Scott Linsingham, trade attorney, trade specialist, trade expert. And so I want to talk a little bit, Scott, about protectionism. And
sure. Because you actually have an upcoming paper on this, don't you, Scott?
Yeah.
And so first thing to do is kind of give the audience like a quick background on what protectionism is, how you define it, or how it's the industry defines it.
Well, yeah. So it's essentially the use of government measures like tariffs or quotas or by national mandates to encourage or force the consumption of national products. Or encourage the production of those same products. And it is, you know, really when it comes down to it, the use of government force or taxpayer dollars to effectuate that type of economic nationalism. So the fact is that protectionism is nothing new. We've had protectionism in one form or another in the United States since basically the founding. The difference is that it had basically been, for lack of a better word, debunked in the United States. In the 90s, peddling protectionism was like peddling snake oil. I mean, it was alchemy. I mean, if you were peddling protectionism, you were kind of laughed out of the room. The fact is, unfortunately, that we've forgotten all of the lessons we learned in the post World War II era when it comes to free trade and protectionism. And so my paper is it seemed to me desperately needed refresher course in all of the reasons why we abandoned protectionism. So instead of being a full-throated defense of free trade, I'm merely going to go back through various periods in U.S. history to examine how badly our experiments with protectionism have failed. And the reason it seemed needed is that, during the presidential campaign, you heard guys like Donald Trump say things like, oh, well, protectionism worked in the past. Like, Hamilton was a big fan of protectionism and Lincoln was a fan of protectionism. And the United States grew because of protectionism after the Civil War. And then, in the 80s, Reagan used a lot of protectionism and it was really, really successful for Harley Davidson and all the rest. And the fact is that every single one of those things I just said is verifiably false. That there have been rigorous academic studies, policy papers, and so forth, entire books written on all of these things that show that even in the 19th century, protectionism was not some sort of magical cure for economic problems. It did not breed economic growth. The best we can say about protectionism in the 19th century is that it didn't harm growth, so that it didn't help growth, but it didn't harm it. The problem is that once you get into the modern economy in the 20th century, then you see irrefutable evidence, starting in really the Smoot-Hawley era, and then moving on, of course, into kind of the 1950s and then into the 1980s. We see irrefutable evidence of how protectionist policies impose far greater economic costs and harms than they do in potential gains for the industry. And in fact, we see that the industries that were protected actually didn't benefit themselves.
Give us an example of that, Scott. What's one of the ways that protectionism failed? And what industry?
So let's see. There were
so many.
Well, yeah. So a really recent example of the failure is just a few years ago, that when President Obama imposed high tariffs on tires from China, the Peterson Institute calculated that the jobs saved, allegedly, from that policy cost approximately $900,000 per job saved. At the same time, it raised costs for poor consumers, driving some of them out of the market entirely. So you had people driving on bald tires because they couldn't afford to get new ones because prices had gone up. You know, so that's a simple example. There was a study in the 80s that went through dozens of protected products and found similar stuff, that the cost of saving these jobs was, you know, something like over $1 million a job in economic costs for American consumers and businesses.
So that's an interesting, you know, question there, because, you know, some people would say, you know, protectionism, it saved my job, but
right,
the opportunity cost that arises from not redirecting that economic energy elsewhere.
And you bring up a good point. I'm just talking about the scene costs. I'm talking about kind of higher prices and welfare loss. You're talking about things that we really can't even calculate. And what that is that, so the extra dollar that I have to spend on a t-shirt or a tire or whatever is $1 that can't go to another industry, or that can't be invested in a new innovative product. The other thing that we don't see is how protectionism actually discourages innovation within the industries that are being protected. There was another great study again back in the 80s that looked back at 16 different industrial sectors in the United States that had been protected since the 1950s, and found that only one of them actually improved its economic performance as a result of that protectionism. The other 15 just kept failing. And the industry that actually did well was bicycles, which is kind of funny considering, where, you know, American bicycle prowess.
I had a Huffy. It was a great bike.
Exactly. And so these other 15 industries, they ended up failing anyway. So not only were you costing hundreds of thousands of dollars per job saved, once the protection went away, the industry hadn't actually gotten its act together and then ended up failing. And then you have, you know, the example of Harley Davidson. Harley's a great example because Harley, you know, the conventional wisdom is that Harley was saved by protectionism. But if you look back, you actually see that what happened was, first, the protectionism imposed was easily circumvented by the Japanese. So the protectionism was on 700cc or above engines. The Japanese just started shipping 699cc engine motorcycles. So they totally circumvented the protection. And the Harley executives later on admitted that what saved them wasn't the protectionism. It was the fact that they actually went to Japan and figured out better managerial techniques and better manufacturing techniques. And they imposed all these sorts of internal reforms that had nothing to do with protectionism, but had to do with getting their own act together for, you know, in their own volition. And there was a great study that showed that the protectionism only benefited Harley about 5% of the total improvement in Harley's business strategy was due to protectionism. The other 95% had absolutely nothing to do with this protectionism. So when you hear guys like Donald Trump saying all this stuff, the fact is that it's been disproven, but we've forgotten it, you know. And the whole point of the paper is that, you know, we're doomed to repeat these mistakes if we don't remember our history.
Well, that's great. That's great. Well, Scott, so one of the things, last things I want to talk about before we get to our final segment here is how to make the positive case for trade. It's not exactly a straightforward kind of subject. Yep. You know, it's got a lot of, you know, high-minded concepts and some math and that sort of thing.
Sure.
So it, from your perspective, what do pro-trade advocates need to do better
I think there's two aspects. One is, again, I think they need to focus more on the alternative to free trade, which is protectionism, and focus on the fact that protectionism has throughout history repeatedly failed. And not only that it has repeatedly failed, but that protectionism is nothing more than a war on your neighbor. You're not actually going after foreigners. What you're doing is sicking the federal government on your neighbor by preventing your neighbor from buying or selling certain goods and services. There's a great quote that I'm forgetting the exact quote now, but it's essentially along those lines that, you know, protectionism is not an action against foreigners, and it's an action against your fellow citizen. Beyond that, I think there needs to be a lot more emphasis on the morality of free trade and the immorality of protectionism. And I say this over and over, but, you know, the fact is that modern protectionism is nothing more than big corporations lobbying the U.S. government to impose hidden taxes on consumers. And, of course, those hidden taxes are shown again and again to fall disproportionately on poor Americans. And they fall also disproportionately on small businesses that consume imports. So you have a situation where essentially a big company like the U.S. steel industry lobbies the U.S. government to impose hidden taxes paid by you and me through either higher prices or tariffs. And those taxes not only hurt American families and consumers, but also hurt a lot of American businesses. And so leaving aside all of the numbers, I mean, we can go through the numbers on manufacturing growth or what the trade deficit really means or what your iPhone's components actually, how those break down. You can go through all this different stuff around wage productivity and the rest, but all of that is really secondary to what free trade really is, and that is simply the absence of government in private transactions, and what protectionism really is, which is getting government in the middle of all of that in order to line the pockets of some well-connected folks at the expense of
consumers. But I think it is important as well to note that there are people at the, you know, at the end of these of these policies, you know, which I don't think you're disputing, but I think that the way to reach people is to tell personal stories. You know, yeah, I think there's a limited appeal to citing graphs and charts and that sort of thing, as I'm sure you readily acknowledge, because we've spoken about this in the past. But I did want to briefly mention, and we talked a bit about this before the show started, but there's this great new podcast out there called Containers. And I'd urge everybody who's interested in the subject to take a look at it or listen to it. It's hosted by Alexis Madrigal. And it one of the things it does is it considers multiple perspectives. So much of the first episode is spent talking to someone who was occupying the port of Oakland during the Occupy movement and getting that perspective. And then talking to a longshoreman who's been out of a job. And then... But what it does is it uses those perspectives to show how even people who are wildly opposed to global capitalism or the mechanics of international trade or this or that policy, it's all interconnected. The international trade is still happening. And these are real policies, and there are real people at the other end of them, which I think is powerful when you consider the opposing point of view and then kind of can weave it together. And I think more stories like that need to be told.
Oh, yeah, definitely. The more that you can actually put a face on what trade is, you know, one of the great myths out there is that trade occurs between nations instead of between individuals. Mm. And the fact is that very little trade is actually conducted between nations. You know, you hear these stories about American competitiveness, and you hear about Germany's trade balance. Well, in the end of the day, those transactions are occurring between you and me and people overseas and companies and private individuals and voluntarily. Nobody is, unfortunately, launching 4K TVs at us. these things are happening through voluntary action. And the more that you can put a face on that, the more you can see that, you know, really, you know, this is government sticking its nose in this. you know, one of the lines I use a lot is that, you know, conservatives, libertarian types recoil at the idea of putting government between us and our doctors, but they seem to have less problem between, you know, putting government between us and our merchants. And that makes no logical sense at the end of the day.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it. Scott, thanks so much for your insight and everything. This is great.
My pleasure, guys.
Yeah.
Glad everything's going well.
Yeah, we do have one more order of business though, and as we do in on every show, we have one gotcha question, and this is one that Neil came up with. I don't know if he was, well, maybe. I don't know. It was
a rare moment of inspiration, Jay. And Scott, I think you'll appreciate this question because I sense that you have something of a contrarian streak to you. So I'm just gonna lay it out there. Scott, is the show Seinfeld overrated?
You are asking the wrong guy, and the answer is no, it is not overrated.
Neil is quickly 0-2 on this one.
Listen, Neil,
or maybe more,
I know that you have some good opinions. Your view of Seinfeld is perhaps your worst. there is no show that has more, except maybe The Simpsons, that has more influenced American pop culture in the last 30 years than Seinfeld. The number of catchphrases and terms that we use on a daily basis that we don't even think about that have come from that show and its genius are—it's, you know, you can't count them on numbers on your fingers and toes.
Yeah, and it's been off the air for almost 20 years.
But the question, my friends, is not: is the show great? The show is obviously a great show, very influential.
Oh, no,
but the question is
changing it.
No, the question is it overrated?
Well, it can't be overrated for the reasons Scott just stated.
So the answer is no.
So it's properly rated, is what you're saying.
I think in some instances it is underrated.
Oh
my God.
There's a shot.
Listen, now, seriously, the other day I was when Rand Paul ran through, there are so many fantastic Seinfeld moments. So when Rand Paul ran through the halls of Congress with his copy machine, I immediately thought of Kramer protesting the U.S. mail with the bucket on the head of the dummy and all of this. I mean, these are moments that are universal in our lives. I mean, can't you imagine Rand Paul protesting the U.S. mail identically to how Kramer did? Can't you? It's perfect.
Yes. All right. See that?
This may be one of the rare disputes where I actually start to shift my position. I don't
yes.
know.
Yes.
No. I'm not there yet. I think I need to ask a few more guests before but I'm starting to doubt myself.
All right. Well, Scott, tell us, tell everybody where they can find you and if you have anything, some upcoming stuff, anything that's,
Well,
horizon?
Actually, I'm speaking at AEI this actually, this is taped, so never mind. You're going to want to cut that. I forgot that this was taped.
when are you speaking?
AEI on Monday.
Oh,
and
yeah, we're
going to Acton Institute on Thursday.
Okay.
So neither of those things are.
So you recently gave a talk at AEI and the Acton Institute, didn't you?
I did. And so that's available online now. And then, like I said, this paper on history of U.S. protectionism will be coming out in a few months. I just kind of putting pen to paper after finishing up the research. And as always, you can find me tweeting too much at my Twitter handle, at Scott Lunsicum.
Yeah,
over at the Cato Institute and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, follow him on Twitter because he's got what he calls the Lindsay Awards that he hands out to I guess the Lindsays that he to stupid people.
Can I get one?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's only for people who are on Twitter.
I can't get one in absentia or in memoriam for my Seinfeld opinion. Isn't the Seinfeld opinion worth one?
It's one of those lifetime achievement awards.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Scott. It was informative as always, and look forward to checking out that paper.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
All right, thank you. All right, and that's going to do it for this episode of the Fifth Estate. As always, we ask you to go out there, review the podcast, subscribe to the podcast, tell everybody about the podcast, because Neil loves it. So, I'm Jake Russo. For Neil Doing, we will see you next time here on the Fifth Estate.